Good morning, everyone. I know everyone says, how do you do that, go to school and did all that stuff, and people look at me like I'm 12. I actually was going to school and working pretty much my entire life, and I'm really glad to not be doing that and just focus on one thing now. So I'm really excited to present this. This was part of my dissertation from a few years ago, and I had a really fantastic collaborative team to do this. Ruth Parker, who's a well-known expert in health literacy, Kathy Miner, who's an incredible adult educator, Katharina Echt, who does a lot with cognitive psychology, and Hannah Cooper, who's a qualitative methodologist. So my model today is the BEAN model, Better Education and Innovation, and it's an action-oriented model that's really grounded in science for how people learn health literacy skills. And I think you'll hear that this ties together some of the things that our previous speakers were talking about. I have no relationships to disclose, but if somebody would like to give me some money to do something, that would be great. So quick outline. I'm a behavioral scientist and health educator, so I'm going to start kind of from there and where these questions came from. I'm going to give you an interdisciplinary perspective on how people learn. That's this intersection between cognitive psychology, adult learning theory, and health literacy. And then I'll actually present the BEAN model and some really concrete strategies we can use for creating interventions, and then just some conclusions and practice implications. So the challenge that I came to was I'd been in behavioral sciences and health education for a while, and why are our interventions not as successful as they could be? And that was a real question. You know, I've spent all this time learning about these great theories of behavior change, and you develop some kind of intervention, and it's still not totally working. Why? And the second piece is we need to find new ways to communicate health information and teach skills to everybody, but particularly low-literate populations. When I was a high school teacher in inner city Chicago, I taught in a Latino school, and there were lots and lots of children and families that health information was just not getting to. It wasn't even a linguistic issue. It was just not being delivered to people in the way they wanted to receive it. So what we need to know. All right, so I'd like to think that behavioral sciences is the answer to all the health problems that we have, but it's not. So what are these outside disciplines we need to start looking to that can add some value to the work we're doing and add a different perspective? And how can we learn from some of our non-traditional partners about how functional skills are taught? And to that, I look towards adult education. So like I said, the field of health behavior change, we need to have some different solutions. So let's talk about health literacy and why that's important. That's something that is minimally taught at Emory, but we do have a great elective that students can take, but not all of our students are learning about health literacy. Nobody's learning about cognitive psychology in public health and where I am, and adult learning theory is really not being talked about in public health either. So what happens when we put these together? So why health literacy? I'm grateful to my other presenters for defining health literacy so I get a couple minutes back of my time. But when we think about health literacy, we know it's not just an issue for poor readers. This is an issue for everybody. My husband is a physician, and I have a PhD, and even when I go into hospitals, I'm often confused. I'm feeling intimidated. I'm not quite sure where I'm supposed to go. So it doesn't really matter who you are and how well you can read. It's an issue for everybody. And it's not just an individual level issue. Certainly, we talked a little bit about in previous presentations about your emotional state. So that's something that exists at an individual level when it comes to receiving health information. If anybody's ever gotten a diagnosis that's really scary or been with somebody in your family or friends that have gotten that diagnosis, it's really hard to listen to anything else anyone says after that. All you're thinking is, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? So it's not just about the individual, it's about the interpersonal. It's about the communication skills that I have, my ability to ask questions, and also my healthcare provider's ability to communicate with me. It's about the organizational level, the culture, the literacy environment, the physical environment. It's, you know, kind of hard to listen when your tushy's cold because you're sitting in a paper gown on a piece of paper and someone comes in fully clothed. That's the organizational environment. We might need to change that. And also the systemic factors, the types of things you have to do in the healthcare. I just had to re-enroll for my benefits. It was very confusing. It took two of us and an outside person to figure out what it was we wanted to sign up for, which one we put our daughter on. And that's a systemic type of issue that relates to health literacy. So in behavioral sciences, we need to work at all these different levels, and health literacy begins to provide a framework for doing that. So why cognitive psychology? Any psychologists in the room? Any people with psych background? One or two? Great. So in the early 1900s, psychology was really all about behaviorism, so things that people are actually doing and not things that are going on in people's heads. So the behaviorist approach was challenged in the 50s by Noam Chomsky with this focus on cognitive psychology, which is what is actually going on in people's heads when they're doing all that stuff. What's the interaction between how they're perceiving information, how they're processing it, how they're organizing information in their head? So when you're sitting here listening to all this information today, I'm kind of looking at all of you thinking, what are you doing with this information? What kind of box are you putting that in your head? How do you organize that? And then what motivates you to behave after that? So cognitive psychology is really interesting. And in public health, we try to get in people's heads all the time. We need to understand that. So cognitive psychology really explains what's going on in your head when you're learning new information. And that is not really a fundamental part of a lot of our interventions. So the last piece is adult learning theory. Any adult educators today? A few? Great. A lot. Okay. So adult learning theory is very interesting. And I come from a background of mostly teaching kids. And so when it comes to teaching adults actually learn very differently. And so adult learning theory really describes the process of how adults learn and start to make meaning from the information that they're getting. It focuses on placing learning in the context of real-life situations. So we're all busy, we have lots of things to do. How do you make something actually applicable to your real life and not theoretical? Adults often don't like that. We don't have a lot of time, we want to make it applicable to what we're doing right now. We want to be able to use it right now, it needs to be relevant. And it also focuses on empowering the participants, whoever your learners are, to pose some of the questions and develop solutions. It's not just about me as the instructor saying, let me tell you everything you need to know. Me saying, well, what is it that you want to know? And what do you think the solution is? And getting people to start to come to those conclusions together. Adult learning theory really provides a lot of guidance on how to create and maximize those learning opportunities. So when you don't have a lot of time, how do you provide a learning opportunity that is really going to do what you need that to do? So we don't have a lot of time with adults. So when we start to put these things together, we can focus on really increasing the effectiveness of our behavior change interventions. And I love this quote at the top, educational practice can only be improved when it's informed by an understanding of how the human mind works. So if we come back to that issue with cognitive psychology and behaviorism, if we don't really understand what's going on in people's heads, how are we going to change what's going on in people's heads and motivate them to behave differently? So I'm going to go through a few relevant concepts from cognitive psychology. The first is that learning is a process. So we learn one thing, and while we're learning it and trying to do something with it, there's more information coming in. You're sitting here for an hour and a half getting a lot of information. So at the same time you're hearing me talk, you're probably processing still some things from the previous presenters. So we have to think about that process, that we can't just deliver information, you know, like APHA style, 3.5 days of rapid fire information. It doesn't work to really get people to motivate them to change their behavior. It's too much. Talk a little bit about the barriers and facilitators throughout the learning process and a couple key terms and concepts. This is actually my favorite part because most people don't know a lot about cognitive psychology and find these pieces really kind of new. So the first one is types of knowledge. There are lots of different ways to define types of knowledge in cognitive psychology, but the first is just a quick distinction between declarative knowledge and procedural knowledge. So declarative knowledge is just the facts. Right? So olive oil is an unsaturated fat. Okay, great. What am I actually supposed to do with that? So the procedural knowledge is knowing how to do something. So something like, if I'm trying to cook collard greens, and I'm from Atlanta, so we cook a lot of collard greens in Atlanta, how do I cook that a little bit healthier? So that's the how-to. And when we talk about health literacy, we're often talking about functional health literacy skills, and that's all about doing. So when you think about creating an intervention, it's not just about delivering lots of information, it's about fostering skill acquisition. How do we help people learn more skills? So this is a very important distinction when you think about creating an intervention. So the next three things, this is how information starts to get in people's heads. We've got three main steps here. So our first is sensory input. So let's just take a minute and listen to all the sounds around us. Okay, so just be quiet for 1 minute. So what are we taking in? And I really am asking that question. Nick? Mm-hmm. What else do you hear? Yeah, the fan, just general air. All right, anybody have a yogurt open? Sometimes there's like a yogurt smell. That could be kind of, it's distracting for me. I don't know if it is for other people. It could be the person next to you is tapping something. It could be just other sounds. So that sensory input, that's all of the things that are seen, heard, tasted, smelled, touched, that's all the stuff in the environment. And so people who have limited sensory abilities, somebody that might be older, somebody that might have limited visual abilities, limited hearing, they have reduced capacity to obtain that information. So it's important to think about who your population is and are they going to have a hard time actually just taking the information in that you want at the very beginning? Is the stuff big enough to see? Is there other distractions going on? And we'll talk in a minute about what happens next if they're not able to get what you need. So those of you who might be sitting in the back, I'm sure you might have a hard time seeing me. At least we have a working microphone. Those are all logistical things that are super important in an intervention. So the effortfulness hypothesis is that individuals have limited cognitive resources at any given time to actually put in sensory information. So think about when you're driving in a car, you're driving down the street, you're looking for an address, what do you instinctively do? Turn the radio down. Well, this is why. It's because you're looking, you're trying to get some visual information, and you just can't take in so much audio information, so you turn the radio down. And so that's cognitive psychology. But if you're in a room, like, I can't turn that person down over there. So I'm just kind of trusting that you all can filter that out. But not everybody can do that. So the next piece is information processing. That's your ability to select and use the meaningful information. So many of you are able to just tune out that voice in the background and say, that's not relevant, I don't need to focus on that, I can just focus on Ariella talking. But a lot of people have a hard time doing that. So you want to make it easy for people to pick the most useful information, like using bullet points if it's on a piece of paper versus big chunks of text. Your working memory is the amount of information that you can remember and manipulate over a short period of time, right? So if you think about, you're hearing the things that I'm saying, you're only able to keep so much of that in your head at one time. And if I'm asking you to keep a lot of that, pieces are going to fall out. So how do I get you to remember the most important things? So some of that's how I'm talking. I'm emphasizing. It's really important not to have a loud environment. Or using slides or using visuals that people can hold on to what's most important. This is all part of developing an intervention. So before your information can get into your long-term memory, you have to process it in your short-term memory, which means you have to be able to figure out what are the most important things you're supposed to hang on to. So again, being able to emphasize to people what they need to know. And if you don't have it in your long-term memory, you can't use it, and you can't change your behavior. So that's why these pieces are very important. And the last piece is comprehension. This ties back to health literacy a lot because it's your knowledge and meaning-making abilities. So folks who have a smaller vocabulary have a harder time making meaning of those words and actually putting them into context. So like when somebody starts talking to me about cars or sports, I don't really have boxes in my head to put that stuff in there. I don't have a sports vocabulary. I don't have a car vocabulary. Just tell me it's blue and I can remember that. You tell me something fancy, I can't remember that. I don't have the vocabulary around those things. So think about yourself in a health environment where you may not really be familiar with all these new terms. Your ability to remember that is really limited. So you don't want to lose your participants before they start. So you want to think about all these pieces related to cognitive psychology that actually impact how someone is going to even hold on to that information and take it out the door, let alone use it. Another couple things that are very important is depth of processing. So how you're able to remember that information, pull it back up and use it, it's affected by how you got the information. Some people are auditory learners, some people are visual learners, some people like to play with stuff. How connected the new information is to existing information. Like I said, I don't have boxes in my head for cars. I don't have anything hanging on to. I won't remember it. And how much time is spent processing it. So you get a lot of information at APHA. Are you processing it? Are you taking it to lunch with you and saying, let me tell you about this information that I heard today that's interesting? So what percent of the information you get here are you actually processing and using versus just hearing and not necessarily using? So the depth of processing exists on a continuum from really shallow to really deep. And the more deeply you process it, the more likely you are to remember it and the more likely you are to use it. So when you're creating an intervention, you want to have a time for people to actually play with that information, teach each other. That's why teach back is such a great strategy, is because it gets people to like say it back. And the more you process it, the more you remember it. So schema theory explains how people view the world. So schema is Greek. It means map or plan or shape. And information that resonates with your schema is a lot easier to remember and recall. So when you're talking with a group of people about how you actually get a disease, if what you're speaking to them actually resonates with what they believe, they're more likely to remember it. If you're teaching somebody something new, this is really often the case with different cultures, different ethnic groups, different belief systems that people come from. If it doesn't resonate with their schema, they're very likely to forget it. So how do you get people to remember that more? And there are lots of strategies that I don't have time to go into today, but if that information doesn't fit the schema, they're going to forget it. And so you have to help work with people to change their schema, and adult learning theory is actually really good at challenging beliefs and getting people to discuss them and start to see new perspectives. So those are a couple quick things about cognitive psychology, and I'll just go briefly into adult learning theory. It's a collection of theories. It's not just one, even though we usually call it adult learning theory. And a lot of the principles of adult learning rely on engaging adults and using them as experts and not just treating them as empty vessels that you need to pour information to. And you need to engage them and get that knowledge to come in first. Adults are goal-oriented and practical, so if you don't see a reason for learning something, you're often not likely to want to be there. And adults like to be treated as equals in the learning experience. This is really important so that people feel like they have some autonomy and that their self is valued. Transformative learning theory does a great job at explaining the process of how adults come to change their perspectives, and there's lots of great literature on that. And additional theories of adult learning emphasizes collaboration, empowerment, reflection. This is something you talked about, reflection journals, as part of the Canyon Ranch Institute. Getting people to sit back and think, is this working? Is this not working? And a lot of these principles use a participatory model, so people are doing things together. And that social support, which I'd also heard you mention, is very important in adult learning theory. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. So when you start to pull all these things together, what does that actually look like? So there are two areas that I had come up with, and first is the environment, and the second are educational strategies. So what is it that matters in the environment? A lot of that is the physical layout, and another piece of it's the social environment, the presence of social support. So look at our environment here. Is this a collaborative looking environment? No, and that's not how our stuff is really set up. It's set up where you're listening and we're talking. So unless I choose to engage you, I don't have to. You don't have to look at each other. You're just looking at me. And that's an important part of adult learning theory, is getting people to start to work together. And then there are also educational strategies for facilitators, listening to people's goals and interests, empowering them, attending to the levels of processing and using repetition, so helping people process information more deeply, activating prior knowledge, so asking people, you know, what do you know about health literacy? What do you know about cancer? What's your understanding of your diagnosis? Presenting information multimodally in different formats and fostering perspective change. So I have some specific strategies under these that I'll mention. So when you put this all together, this is the BEAN model. So it's an instructional foundation for how you help people acquire and use and share functional health literacy skills. So when we start on the side, we have cognitive psychology and adult learning theory. And putting those together, like I just mentioned, that comes into what are those environmental factors and educational strategies you can use when you're creating an intervention. And when you use those together, that can really help facilitate knowledge and skill acquisition. But it doesn't stop there, and this is what's interesting, and this is where you really start to rely on other fields. If you're getting people to just acquire the knowledge and skills, it's great, but you want them to actually use the knowledge. So that's behavior change. As behavioral scientists and health educators, that's what we're interested in. But where does the knowledge sharing come in? This is a piece that's interesting because in adult education, people are often sharing information with each other. And that actually can facilitate and increase their knowledge and their skills and their use of it. Because if I'm telling you these great things that I've learned, that's actually very motivating for me. Like, did you know you're supposed to walk 30 minutes a day, 5 times a week? That's really important. And if I keep saying that, I'm much more likely to do it because I keep talking about it. And this is what happens in the adult education environment, is people start talking to each other and they start talking to people outside the class, and that actually reinforces the skills that they have. So what do these things look like? So in an adult education setting, the classrooms are often set up in a U-shape for discussion and collaboration. That's not often what format our sessions are set up in. They're set up very didactically, where they're just rows and there's a speaker. But this actually works well in adult education to get people talking to each other. And the social environment is very different. People are comfortable to ask questions, comfortable to share experiences and use humor. As part of my research, I was doing observation, and I was always so surprised by what a nice environment it was. Very, very different feeling than when you go to the doctor's office. And the participants really encouraged each other, and they encouraged by the instructor. I remember one of the sessions, someone brought grapes in, and everyone was like, hey, that's great, you got grapes today instead of chips, pass them on over. And then people brought grapes the next week. And so that kind of social support was very important in the environment. And you can see what's the origin of those things. So we've got cognitive psychology and adult learning theory together with the physical environment. And then for the social environment, a lot of that really comes from adult learning theory. So you'll see that kind of distinction in these other sections here. So another thing, attending to the goals and interests of the students. Incorporating goal setting into an intervention. That's a really important piece if you want to get people's buy-in to changing their behavior. It's not just my goals, it's what are your goals too. And also empowering the participants and fostering autonomy. So teaching people how to create an action plan to meet the goals. So if anybody's ever tried to lose weight, how do you actually create an action plan to do that? If you're not creating those steps, those strategies to get to where you need to go, that's not going to be very effective. And similarly, time for participants to reflect on progress towards the goals. I actually have a weekly club with some of my students where we call it CIE Club, Continuously Increasing Effectiveness. And we sit and write for half an hour on Tuesday mornings at 10. Anybody who's in Atlanta, welcome to come and join us. And we write about how are we doing and our progress towards our goals. We don't share it. It's very personal. But that time that I have to reflect on that's been really important for me, and it works for my students. And that works for folks in adult education. That works in medical settings, too. The next piece is attending to those levels of processing. So one of the things adult educators do that I find fascinating is they often talk about, while you're listening to this, listen like you're going to have to explain it to somebody else. And people listen very differently when they have to do that. Also activating prior knowledge. So instructors begin a session, if you're going to talk about nutrition, by saying, what'd you eat today? And everybody goes around and talks about it, rather than launching into all these things you're supposed to do and not do, just engaging people in where they are and what they know. So what'd you eat today? Oh, well, do you think that was pretty healthy, not so healthy? What do you think about that? What do you guys think about that? And starting a discussion that way, and people start to feel very accountable and interested in each other. So presenting information multimodally, writing on the board, using flashcards, a handout, some kind of visual, some kind of video, all of these different ways of presenting things get people in different ways. You've got a diverse group, everybody learns in a different way. In terms of fostering perspective change, it's important to explain the how and the why and the impact. So we always have to balance in health education how much information is too much. But if you're trying to motivate people, you want them to understand the how and the why. Otherwise, they may not actually take that somewhere. You want to discuss those beliefs, those concerns, and those misconceptions. And so the value of sharing within the class is really important. Oftentimes, if you're just having an instructor present and nobody else is presenting, you're missing out on the fact that if people are actually going to take that and use it in the community, your participants are often more knowledgeable of the community resources than the actual instructor is, and they become a really valuable resource for each other. Participants, no matter who your instructor is or how great they are, participants often use a similar terminology in plain language. So they're able to explain it to each other better than somebody else's, even if your instructor is of that community. And it also provides opportunities for participants to hear other personal experiences, see themselves in other people, and be more motivated to change because they're able to learn from each other and see somebody else that they could be in 10 years. So a few implications for research and practice. Approaching intervention development not just with a focus on teaching information, but with a focus on teaching skills. So when you teach skills, people are able to take those things and do something with it, not just walk away being interested in something. Also attending to the instructional foundation and the theoretical foundation of behavior change. So I like social cognitive theory very much. I like the health belief model. But what's the instructional model that is behind that? And that's often missing from interventions. Using the strengths of adult education to teach the functional skills. So balance the content. So I have all this content, but how do I balance that with what your goals are as a participant and make those go together? And how do I break down these complex concepts into ideas that people can actually use? And adult education does a great job of doing that. And last, this is a tricky one. We could talk about this one for a while, but equipping your participants as lay health advisors so that you know that the information they go and share is going to be accurate. So things like, I'm going to make extra copies of the handout so I can give it to people so they can take it to somebody else and share it with another person. All those pieces are important because we know people share information. We want to make sure it's accurate. So how do we do that? And I look forward to your questions in a moment. Thank you.